From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The U.S. Supreme Court is America's main line to interpretation of the Constitution, and where its next new member sits on that bench, center, right, or far right seem to be the options, is hugely consequential. When it's the law of the land, the stakes could hardly be bigger. Tonight on Point, the new Supreme Court nominee, Judge John Roberts, and the High Court redefining itself and American life for a new century. We begin tonight in Washington, where Senate lawmakers responded today as Judge Roberts made his first rounds. Susan Page is Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. I asked her to give us a sense of John Roberts' reception on Capitol Hill.
He's had a very good day. He's gone up with Fred Thompson, better known as an actor on Law and Order, but a former senator who's taking charge of this nomination confirmation process. He was up on the Hill meeting with key senators, including the Democratic leader of the Senate, Harry Reid, and there was no one who opposed him, and of course, Republicans embracing him very, very much.
Tell us more about that reception, first from Republican Senate leaders.
Well, there seems to be no Republican who's against him. Very enthusiastic endorsements, both from Republicans who are kind of traditional mainline Republicans concerned about economic issues and things like that that come before the court, and also from the social conservatives like Sam Brownback of Kansas or Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania. President Bush seems to have found someone who appeals to both of those big elements in the Republican Party.
And what about on the Democratic side? We see no outright calls for his rejection as yet from any of the Senate's 44 Democrats. Are the Democrats going to put up a fight here or stroke their chins and vote him in?
You know, I think that some Democrats will try to raise tough questions, especially on Roe v. Wade, the 1973 decision that recognized abortion rights. Chuck Schumer of New York, for instance, has said he plans to press that issue. Ted Kennedy from Massachusetts has raised some questions and, of course, voted against John Roberts when his confirmation came up before the Judiciary Committee for the appeals court slot. But no Democrat has said that they will vote against him, and I think they've struggled to find the grounds on which they would oppose him. So things sometimes come up in confirmation processes that you don't expect, but so far this has been a very good opening for John Roberts.
There was a tremendous hullabaloo, of course, just a few weeks ago about the use of the filibuster in the case of judicial confirmations. We saw the Senate almost going to the so-called nuclear option there. Is there any talk at this point about the filibuster in the case of John Roberts, which would presumably be the only way Democrats might block him?
I think the only signs we see from that gang of 14, seven Democratic and seven Republican senators who averted a showdown over judicial filibusters in May, all the signs from them is that John Roberts does not present the kind of extraordinary circumstance that would make a filibuster permissible. John McCain, who's a Republican from Arizona, said he thought that clearly John Roberts was in the acceptable range of nominees. And I think this is a good sign. Democrats, I think, will not be able to filibuster John Roberts without the support of those seven Democrats who were part of the Gang of 14. And so far, all the signs from them is that they do not find him such an unacceptable candidate that they would back a filibuster.
What did Judge Roberts himself have to say today? He was very well-spoken with the president last night. Was he speaking up much today or just getting handshakes?
I think he was mostly shaking hands and avoiding answering the questions that everybody's curious about. What exactly is his position on Roe v. Wade? Would he be a much more conservative vote on the court, or more reliably conservative vote on the court than Sandra Day O'Connor, who he hopes to replace? I think that these questions will continue to be asked over the next several months, but I think they are unlikely to be answered, including in the confirmation hearings that we expect to start the last week of August or the first week of September.
Now, why do you say that? Why won't those answers come in confirmation hearings?
Well, what we've seen with us nominations for the Supreme Court for a decade or more is that nominees do not answer hypotheticals. They say they can't prejudge a court case. They would have to look at the specifics of what came before the court. And that's been part of a strategy to get confirmed, to avoid saying things that give your opponents kind of a foothold to argue against you.
Sandra Day O'Connor saying, quoted in the Spokesman Review out of Spokesman, Washington, calling John Roberts a brilliant legal mind, good in every way except he's not a woman. What about women on the Hill? Are they concerned about that?
Isn't it interesting there was some disappointment among women, also among Hispanics. A lot of speculation that President Bush would name the first Hispanic ever to the High Court. He decided not to do that. You know, interestingly, in the USA Today CNN Gallup poll, we found that 3 out of 4 Americans like the idea of a woman, and 2 out of 3 like the idea of an Hispanic. So, you know, sometimes we wonder if presidents follow the polls, but in this case, President Bush did not.
So what's your sense, Susan? The Democrats kind of hanging back so far, largely, so as not to appear rejectionist, or are we seeing the makings of a Judge Roberts bandwagon here that's just going to sail through?
You know, I think that if there are some liberal Democrats who would like to oppose John Roberts, who would prefer to see a nominee like Alberto Gonzalez, the Attorney General, who would be more like Sandra Day O'Connor. But I think there's a sense that you can't just oppose a Supreme Court nomination because you don't like the politics of the president who appointed him. And so while we see the interest groups out there, NARAL, Pro-Choice America, which supports abortion rights, announced it would oppose Judge Roberts, now held a demonstration against him on the Hill this morning as he arrived. I think that the elected Democrats just don't, at the moment at least, see an opening to oppose him.
Susan Page, thank you so much for joining us.
Tom, it was great to be with you.
Susan Page is Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. She spoke with us from Washington. Of all the items President George W. Bush would like to leave as his legacy, a transformed Supreme Court has always been near the top of the list. Now his chance is opening up to change the basic direction of the court, and with it, the framework of American life on abortion, affirmative action, federal power, states' rights, and more. This hour, On Point, we'll look with some of the country's top legal minds at the president's new nominee, Judge John Roberts, and the High Court's outlook being redefined in a new century. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you see the court at a crossroads and American life there with it? Which way would Justice Roberts steer? And what's at stake in filling Sandra Day O'Connor's seat on the U.S. Supreme Court? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York City is John McGinnis. He is a conservative professor of law at Northwestern University School of Law and a widely recognized authority on the Rehnquist Court. He worked alongside John Roberts for 3 years at the Office of Legal Counsel during the George H.W. Bush administration. John McGinnis, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And joining us from Watertown, Massachusetts, is Lawrence Tribe. He is a liberal thinker and renowned professor of law at Harvard Law School. If John Kerry had been elected president, it might well have been Larry Tribe's nomination we'd be talking about tonight. Lawrence Tribe, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guests.
Let's dive straight in. And with Lawrence Tribe, if I may, Larry Tribe, how do you see this? John Roberts, is he cut from the O'Connor conservative cloth, or is this a jurist who would line up with Scalia and Thomas in really tilting the balance of the court?
Well, of course, when I knew him as a student and when I have sort of seen him in practice and kept in touch with him over the years, I didn't have occasion to pigeonhole him one way or the other, and it's the Bush administration, with President Bush having announced quite early that he is looking for someone cut from the Scalia-Thomas cloth, that seems to think that's what it has in John Roberts. Like Scalia, Roberts is brilliant. Unlike Scalia, Roberts is quiet and not brashy. He's not a flame-throwing sort of guy. He's soft-spoken, but the question that I think a lot of Americans are going to want to ask is whether there is an iron fist inside that velvet glove and whether he really is a person whose view of liberty, whose view of privacy, whose view of government versus the individual, though not out of the mainstream, is a view that if fully developed and explained to Americans, would leave them feeling, well, that's not the Constitution we thought we had. Now, I don't really have much evidence bearing on that. And I start with an open mind and with a favorable inclination because I know and like the guy. Mm. But I think there are a lot of questions that need to be answered. as part of a kind of national seminar, even if we knew in advance for sure that he had all the votes.
We're trying to get that seminar going tonight. John McGinnis, you know John Roberts well, worked with him. Conservatives have been yearning for years to change the balance of the court, to radically change the outlook and impact of the court. Is this the man to do that in the Thomas Scalia vein?
It's an important appointment, and perhaps more important than if John Roberts had replaced the Chief Justice. But I don't think we should exaggerate. I think putting this in, I think it's useful to put it in a longer historical perspective. He probably will continue what I see as a long-term trend of the Supreme Court over the last two decades of giving more weight to the text of the Constitution and its historic and stable meaning. But he's not going to represent a radical break from what has become before. As the foremost litigator before the court, with the possible exception of your other guest, Professor Tribe, he has great respect for the court as an institution. And like any institutionalist, I'm sure he understands that change is more secure when it's incremental.
Let me understand how you would see a radical break. Do you see Clarence Thomas as representing a man who would promote a radical break with court tradition?
Well, again, I see him in some sense as part of this trend to give, which I think is a very deep-rooted trend and isn't only on the court but in legal scholarship of giving more weight to the text of the Constitution and its historic meaning. I think he is on the more radical, the stronger side of that, and I believe that Judge Roberts is likely to have some more institutionalist ballast that he brings to the table.
Jack Beatty, we'll be right back. We want to get your view as well. We're talking tonight about the new Supreme Court nominee, Judge John Roberts, and the High Court redefining itself and American life for a new century. Lawrence Tribe is with us, and John McGinnis. You can join the conversation. Which way do you think Justice John Roberts would steer? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about President Bush's new Supreme Court nominee, Judge John Roberts, and where a Justice John Roberts would tilt the balance of the U.S. Supreme Court. You can join the conversation tonight. What's at stake in filling Sandra Day O'Connor's seat? And what does the Supreme Court stand for to you? Do you like what it stands for? Do you want it to stay that way? Do you want it to change? How do you think Justice Roberts would steer it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight by Harvard Law School's Lawrence Tribe and John McGinnis from Northwestern University School of Law. Let's get a couple of voices from Washington today on the air with us here. Here's Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, ranking member on the Judiciary Committee, speaking to Judge Roberts' nomination today.
No one is entitled to a free pass to a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court. Someone confirmed today can be expected to serve on the court until the year 2030 or later.
No free pass. We'll see what comes out of the confirmation hearings. But today, Senator John Cornyn, a Republican from Texas, speaking strongly in support of Judge Roberts.
The question I have is, are they looking for a fight, or are they looking for an orderly and dignified process where we will do our job of advice and consent? I think clearly Judge Roberts should be a consensus nominee.
So Duke's up, but how high the Dukes are up is not clear tonight. Jack Beatty, how do you see this nomination unfolding and the stakes in it?
Well, you know, I think the confirmation hearings will properly pay a lot of attention to privacy rights under the 14th Amendment and abortion rights and so on. But I hope that the Commerce Clause doesn't get lost in this. There is an appetite among people on the court to strike down laws that don't seem to the court to be justified under the Commerce Clause. And one of his opinions, Judge Roberts' opinions on the circuit, on the appeals court, was a Commerce Clause environmental case under the Commerce Clause that he voted against. And behind these many of these conservatives, there's a whole movement really that wants to call into question the regulatory apparatus erected since and during the New Deal, and that sort of thing through the prosaic Commerce Clause powers of the Congress. That could actually have more bearing on how Americans live their daily lives than any other part of the law now in debate in the country.
If the federal government is ruled to not have the right to regulate interstate commerce, all kinds of things could fall. Larry Tribe, help us open up this seminar further. Here, I want to get this out in very plain terms. I'm reading here from the New York Times editorial today, and here's what it says. I'd like to get your response. It says, the far right is on a drive to resurrect ancient and discredited states' rights theories. If extremists take control of the Supreme Court, we will end up with an America in which the federal government is powerless to protect against air pollution, unsafe working conditions, and child labor. And it goes right on. The Endangered Species Act, environmental controls, all kinds of federal protections, unconstitutional. Is that the debate we're in the midst of here? Is that what's at stake here?
Well, I think in answering that question, we have to remember that the strongest states' rights proponent on the Supreme Court was Sandra Day O'Connor. When the court, in an opinion by much more liberal John Stevens, upheld the power of Congress through the Commerce Clause to regulate every last bit of marijuana possession in the country, including marijuana possessed and used for purely medicinal purposes in California. Mm-hmm. The vote was 6-3, and the dissenters were Justices Thomas and O'Connor and the Chief Justice. So Justice O'Connor is being replaced by someone who couldn't possibly be more states' rights oriented than she is, and indeed I would rather think that a Justice Roberts would be with Justice Scalia in that case. Scalia was with the majority, was with Justice Stevens. I think the more radical threats have to do with liberty and privacy, and I want to just use this brief opportunity to address what Professor McGinnis said earlier when he said that there is a long-term trend toward paying more attention to the text and its historic meaning.
Yes.
Making it sound as though somehow we are moving from a court that was making it up as it went along and imposing its own values to a court that's sort of doing law. I think that's a fundamental mirage. It's an illusion. Take one rather simple example, the case that now there's a lot of national attention to, of the little 12-year-old girl with the French fry in the subway system in the metro.
In Washington, D.C., right.
In Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. under a really extreme policy that was laughed out of existence after this case. There was a rule that said, basically, one French fry and you're out. This poor girl, 12 years old, opened a little bag, had one French fry. She gets arrested, she gets handcuffed, she gets put in a police car, she's held in custody for hours, she's got a record. And the question that reached Judge Roberts on the D.C.
Yes.
Circuit,
mm-hmm.
you know, is whether this flat rule applying only to minors was unconstitutional because of the Fourth Amendment and the Due Process Clause. I can't go through the whole legal analysis, but it was quite remarkable and certainly a subject for inquiry what the text and history of the Constitution meant here, because when Judge Roberts, as part of a unanimous group of three, said the Constitution doesn't protect her, he relied on an opinion by the Supreme Court of a couple of years earlier that involved seatbelts, and again, I won't bother anyone with the details, but in that case, Justice O'Connor dissented, saying that fidelity to the Fourth Amendment's command of reasonableness and sensitivity to the competing values protected by the Fourth Amendment makes that kind of rule impermissible, even if the cop has discretion not to arrest, and in this case it was even worse. O'Connor, who dissented there, is being replaced by a judge who, in a case where liberty should have gotten more textual protection, went the other way. So it's a question not of whether you pay more attention to the text and its history. It's a question of how you understand the text and its history. That's a question that needs to be explored without the pretense that they're the good guys who read the Constitution and its history and simply do their job, and they are gradually replacing the bad guys who are legislating from the bench. Those slogans, I think, are just too well-worn for the American people to buy. And I'm not saying that applying a more kind of intellectually honest approach would end up with a conclusion that John Roberts shouldn't be confirmed. That's not the question I'm interested in right now. I'm interested in trying to help frame the national debate so that we ask sensible questions instead of pretending that there's some kind of long-term trajectory toward objective truth.
John McGinnis, let's stick with this theme for a moment, if we may. I'm looking here at a press release. This came out when John Roberts was nominated to the D.C. Circuit. It's from the Alliance for Justice. I don't even know what they are, but they clearly opposed his nomination. And here's a statement that they made, and I wonder what you think of it. They said, every nominee bears the burden of showing that he or she respects and pledges to protect the progress made in the areas of civil rights and liberties, the environment, and Congress's constitutional role in protecting the health and safety of all Americans. Do you agree, John McGinnis, that every nominee has the burden of showing that they respect that progress?
Well, first of all, I'd like to just briefly respond to Professor Tribe. I think it's very important that just to understand that Justice Roberts was a judge on an inferior court, and he was following the Supreme Court's precedent in that case. It was a unanimous decision. So I don't think it's fair to contrast him with Justice O'Connor. Who was on the court, having much more latitude as a Supreme Court justice? With respect to, I certainly agree that it is a test for all justices to respect our liberties. The Constitution represents an anchor of our liberties, but it's an anchor precisely because it takes its guidance from a stable text, not from the hurly-burly of the politics of the moment.
But what about this notion of progress that's been made?
Yes, we certainly have made progress, and we've made progress largely through both constitutional amendments and then reinterpretations of the Constitution that come to better understandings of the constitutional text, like Brown versus Board of Education, which overruled a decision in Plessy versus Ferguson, which was, in my view, against the clear principle against racial discrimination that is at the core of the 14th Amendment.
But I think
the Constitution is itself a charter for liberties. And the difficulty with progress, arguing that it's a matter of progress, who's to decide exactly what progress is?
Well, exactly, which is why we're asking, because, of course, many people have an idea what it is. Some may oppose it. The argument feels as though it may drift toward this, that whether or not John Roberts will join, let's say, Clarence Thomas and Scalia in taking the United States back to a kind of pre-New Deal sense of itself and what the government ought to be up to. Do you think that's the goal?
There's absolutely no chance of that. On economic matters, it is quite settled that the federal government has large powers of regulations. We're arguing over the margin in non-economic matters about whether we're going to give some more decentralization to power to the states. We're going to have more competition in social norms on non-economic matters. There's really no at all threat to any commercial or economic matters that the federal government wants to regulate. I believe that even the farthest reaches of what the so-called Federalist Revolution has done doesn't touch those secure powers of the federal government.
Lawrence Tribe, do you agree?
I certainly hope that John McGinnis is right. Justice Thomas has made quite clear that he thinks the broad proposition embraced at the moment, even by Chief Justice Rehnquist and by Justice Kennedy, also a believer in states' rights, that the broad proposition that economic matters are within the purview of the federal government has no basis in the text of the Constitution. And certainly there is a large movement behind him, and I don't have any reason to think that John Roberts has that view, although he wrote a piece on the contract clause that I happen to like, a piece that suggests that the economic liberties that have not received much protection since the era of the court under pre-1937, and that those economic liberties should get more protection. So I think there's a bit more play in the joints there than Professor McGinnis suggests. But I return to my theme that the most fundamental threat to worry about now is not so much the balance of power between the federal government and the states, but the balance of power between the beleaguered individual and all of government, whether the individual is a woman who, for reasons of health, claims that she needs an exception to a flat ban on a particular procedure of abortion or on a particular parental notification rule, or whether it's something not yet on the radar screen. age of 50, is awfully young. There were only three other justices as young or younger appointed in the last 43 years, and they happened to be Thomas, Scalia, and Rehnquist. I think of my granddaughter, born a year and 3 months ago, and I think of the fact that she's going to be 30. Thanks. It's a great part of my life. I think of the fact that she's going to be 30 when John Roberts is still deciding cases, perhaps. And that means that we have to think very hard, not about whether he's brilliant and very decent, he's certainly that, but whether his vision of the Constitution is going to be compatible with our own fundamental beliefs.
We've got a lot of callers who want to join us. I want to begin to turn to them. John McGinnis, Lawrence Tribe. Jack, please stand by. George is calling from West Salem, Wisconsin. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Great show, as always.
Thanks, George. What do you think?
Well, got 3 points. The first one is, in terms of the abortion issue, which is obviously primary in everybody's mind, from what I understand, most recent decisions from the Supreme Court relating to that issue have been decided on a 3-6 ratio, typically supporting, Roe versus Wade.
Right, the sort of fundamental 3-6 there, yep.
Right, yeah, so I don't see that is really the key issue yet in terms of this appointment. What I see key issue is, I guess, the only decision or dissent that Roberts has written involved something to do with the Endangered Species Act, and where he may provide kind of an anti-environmental flavor to the Supreme Court, more conservative, more supportive to industry, trying to or deregulate some of the current environmental regulations we have in place.
Does that sound like a revolution to you, George, or within the margin that you're comfortable with?
Well, it isn't, because I think we're already headed in that direction in a lot of ways. I think the EPA has had a lot of influence removed in the last 5 years, so I think that's a concern for a lot of people. And then the third issue is, from what I understand, Roberts may have been involved, not as official counsel, but unofficial counsel to Governor Bush in 2000 when he was receiving legal advice about how to handle the recount and the voting issues in Florida.
Yep, we'll pick those up, George. Thanks very much for your call. John McGinnis, to you, first on abortion. George says, look, the fundamental defense of Roe v. Wade is a 6-3 decision. On the other hand, there's all kinds of issues about restrictions, partial birth abortion. How do you see a Justice John Roberts impacting the abortion view of the court?
It is true that the fundamental right to abortion is secured by a 6-3 vote. Of course, the question of what an undue burden is in specific cases is unclear, and there have been some decisions about that are 5-4. So I think there could be, again, some incremental changes in that law as there could be in other areas. But I don't think we're going to see certainly a sea change there.
And on environmental issues, Judge Roberts is seen as being friendly to business. Does that mean unfriendly to the environment?
I think that's just a mistake. It's also important to understand that Judge Roberts, in the case to which the caller referred, actually just was asking for the case to be reheard because he thought the jurisprudence of the D.C. Circuit on which he sat was in tension with some prior decisions of the Supreme Court. So I don't think we really can learn a lot about that simply from that. I think, again, he would focus on the question of whether there's an economic nexus, and if there is, I think he is going to allow the federal government to regulate it. And with most environmental regulations, the huge number of environmental regulations, there's just going to be no problem in that respect.
Lawrence Tribe, I know we just have you for another minute here. Let me ask you, you spoke of your granddaughter. She could be 30 with a Justice Roberts still on the bench. You know that for decades, a lot of conservatives have just been so unhappy with the direction of the court. Can you imagine American liberals being equally unhappy 10, 20, 30 years from now?
Easily. My daughter was born in the year of Roe v. Wade, and it's hard for someone like her to imagine a time when reproductive freedom was nibbled away at the margins, incrementally, step by step. But that's, of course, what the people who are eager to push the court toward the right hope for and look for, and I can easily imagine liberals being distressed. But remember, there are going to be more more than a few presidential elections between now and then, and there'll be other vacancies. I think that we ought not to understate the importance of this nomination. So many issues have been decided 5-4. Affirmative action could go the other way if O'Connor were replaced, you know, by Roberts. But we should also not overestimate it. We shouldn't say that the sky is falling.
And we won't, Larry Tribe, with that. We're out of time. Lawrence Tribe of Harvard Law School, thank you so much for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new Supreme Court nominee, Judge John Roberts, and the High Court redefining itself and American life for a new century. You can join us tonight. What are you hoping for or worrying about as Roberts heads for Senate scrutiny? And is it time for a filibuster or all in favor, say aye? We're joined tonight by John McGinnis. He's professor at Northwestern University School of Law, was deputy assistant attorney general at the Office of Legal Counsel in the first Bush administration, that's George H.W., when John Roberts was deputy solicitor general there. We're joined right now from Berkeley, California, by Jesse Choper, professor of public law at the Bolt Hall School of Law at the University of California at Berkeley, former law clerk for Chief Justice Earl Warren. Jesse Choper, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Nice to be here.
So the question we've got on the table is just how fundamentally, if it comes to Justice John Roberts, and there's a lot of confident talk about that today, how fundamentally that might change the profile of the court, what great doctrines might be changed, how it might change American life. What do you see?
Well, what you have to do under these circumstances is to compare Justice Roberts to Justice O'Connor. Justice O'Connor was for more than 20 years, if not the most powerful public official in America, which I think she was.
As the swing vote there.
She certainly was the most powerful Supreme Court justice, and this was a court made up during virtually all of her time of five conservative-leaning justices, some leaning, some falling all the way in the other direction, and a similar four liberals in a similar posture on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
She was the one that could be most quickly, most readily brought over the line to join four liberals and make a fifth liberal result. Well, that's not going to happen.
And if it doesn't happen, what take us through? What would go the other way? What might go the other way?
Well, let me give you the 5-4 decisions that we've had that I think would go the other way. All right?
Sure.
I mean, just in recent times and big ones.
Mm-hmm.
Just last year, the 110 Commandments case that the court found violative of the Establishment Clause.
Mm.
She was the fifth vote, joining the four liberals for that position. And the term before, the question of the extension of federal habeas corpus jurisdiction to Guantanamo.
Mm.
She was the one conservative who joined the four liberals for that result. Earlier in the term, she was the fifth liberal vote to uphold basic provisions of the McCain-Feingold bill concerning regulation of campaign finance reform.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, there was certainly one of the great issues in American government today.
Mm-hmm.
Have I said enough so far?
Well, we see the list shaping up right there. And you would imagine on each of those, John Roberts going the other way, or you're just...
That's what I would imagine, yes. There are no guarantees in life or in predicting Supreme Court decisions.
Jack Beatty, it seems sort of inarguable that Sandra Day O'Connor stood as a huge swing vote there. Jesse Choper says he just thinks Roberts would swing the other way. That's a lot of swinging.
That is a lot of swinging, and it would also be a 5-4 vote on a Nebraska case affirming the striking down an anti-partial birth abortion law, and it would be a 5-4 vote on the affirmative action before that. So, yeah, lots of things swing by that one vote. And this makes this nomination, because it is Justice O'Connor, really so much more consequential than it would have been just if he were replacing the Chief Justice. This is a big one, and for those reasons, I mean, but it's hard for me to see. I mean, just practically how Democrats could possibly filibuster him on the basis of cases that he will not divulge. And he won't say how he would have voted in those cases. So really, we're sort of with the professor. We don't know what he's going to do.
John McGinnis, you know John Roberts as well as any of us, much better. How about it? Do you see him as walking away from the Sandra Day O'Connor leanings on these swing votes? Do you see him as sort of ticking the box on the opposite side and shifting all those, the 5-4 the other way?
Well, I don't think we can know in any specific case how Justice Roberts is going to rule, and I certainly don't think he can be asked about specific cases. I think we can see him as part of this long-term trend to textualism in the court, and that's where I would put him. And the one break on that, I think, is he is a very strong institutionalist. And so I think it is a mistake to think he's going to come to the court and they'll overrule the McCain-Feingold Act or anything of that sort. I think he will take precedent extremely seriously. That doesn't mean as new cases come before the court, he won't give greater weight to text and the historic meaning of text than Justice O'Connor did in some cases. And so over time, there may be some decisions. But I do not think we're going to see cases simply being overruled because Justice Roberts is joining the court. There may be a different tone over time. And I would say, again, that's part of the culmination of a trend. It's nothing, it's not something radical or new. This has been happening for the last two decades, a movement in this direction.
Well, Larry Tribe isn't with us, but of course he pushed back on that earlier, saying there's nothing inevitable or natural about that trend.
I certainly agree there's nothing inevitable or natural about that trend. I do think there are strong forces in American life that are leading in that direction. Even, I believe, liberal justices pay more attention to the text than they did in the Warren Court era. And I would disagree with Professor Tribe that you can't say that there are some decisions that the Warren Court era and some of the Bergen Court actually made up, that actually have no demonstrable basis in the text of the Constitution. And that is a very worrying phenomenon because it's very unclear where the Supreme Court has the justification to come and make up laws like that. And therefore, I think it's a very salutary development that we're going back to a more legalistic court, a court that is actually taking the rule of law extremely seriously by applying it to themselves.
Jesse Choper, what do you make of that argument? Do you see that trend? Do you think John Roberts would continue it? And what about its impact on American life? Will it change the world as we know it?
Let me say this. I certainly agree. I wanted to be clear. I did not suggest that a Justice Roberts would vote to overturn those decisions. That's a wholly different kettle of fish.
Mm-hmm.
I'm simply saying that going forward, this is the kind of difference he would make had he been there at the time these cases were originally decided.
Okay.
So far as the notion of a greater adherence to textualism, I think we have some justices who are quite directed at that. It certainly has not been a universal process. When the court held, about 5 or 6 years ago, that the doctrine of sovereign immunity, saying that states could not be sued without their consent, even in their own courts, an important decision in some ways. There was admittedly no textual basis for that at all. When the court similarly held at about the same time, and back to middle 90s, the states' state legislatures could not be commandeered, and subsequently that state executive branch, state executive official like police chiefs, this had to do with the Brady Act, could not be commandeered. Once again, those were, as admitted by those who went that way, said that there was no textual basis for this. Well, they rely on a sort of an original understanding. And then, of course, it gets murkier than the text.
But
one says we ignore everything in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. We do what we want. Everyone says, well, yes, of course we pay some attention to them, but there's some thought about what was the original understanding.
But if the court moves toward a more textual view, are ordinary Americans going to feel a kind of whiplash in the lives they lead, in the way the legal framework of the country supports them, or otherwise?
Yeah, I think that's pretty strong. I don't think it is going to go that way at all. Mm. It is, however. I don't want to paper this over. I think this is the single most important Supreme Court change, if you will, since the middle 1980s, and indeed since the early 1970s, when there was a liberal majority under the Warren Court, and it changed with President Nixon's appointments. It hasn't changed back since then. It's not going to change back to a liberal court, but you had a court that did quite well for a four-justice minority. And they did quite well because of two justices almost all the time. Justice O'Connor, a majority of that time, and Justice Kennedy, something less than a majority. To lose that opportunity for the liberals to get the fifth vote is going to make a distinct, marked difference. Will it change American life? No, I don't think it's going to change American life. But it will make it. Look, we're going to have a whole bunch of cases on the war on terrorism and the conflict between the government's ability to deal with it and individual rights. Guantanamo, that I mentioned earlier,
yes,
was a not an unimportant, but a precursor. That would have gone the other way, I think,
mm-hmm,
had Justice O'Connor not been there. We're going to see much greater deference to the government on behalf of a majority of the court in the future. I'll say one: whether that changes American life is in the eyes of the beholder.
I want to begin to get our callers in here again. Kate is calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Kate. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
With all due respect to your esteemed folks there, I'm curious because you guys haven't mentioned the fact that the biggest issue on hand here is the Roe v. Wade decision that was made before, and the fact that you are replacing a female Supreme Court justice with a potential male nominee. And, you know, for this entire hour, it's been three men chatting about that, and I haven't heard really the female perspective, nor have you guys really mentioned the fact that the number of women on the Supreme Court is going to be reduced by one.
Well, we have talked about it in this hour. We had Terry O'Neill from the National Organization for Women last night, but your point is loud and clear and a good one, that this is exactly what an awful lot of people are thinking about. John McGinnis, if I may come back to you on it, how do you see John Roberts standing on Roe v. Wade? How do you see how a Justice Roberts might change the court's consensus there?
Again, I really don't know how in any specific case, but I'd like to direct, I think the caller's perspective on law is fundamentally different from my own, and I do think in this sense fundamentally different from Justice Roberts.
In what respect?
That there's a kind of female perspective on law, and Judge Roberts coming in changes that because he's male. I think the president was right to try to pick the best person for the job, regardless of race and gender, because the law has an objective meaning. I think Judge Roberts would agree, irrespective of your race, color, and creed, and that is our common bond. And I think it's very important not to think there's a law viewed by women and a law viewed by men, a law viewed by people of one race or another.
Well fair enough, but Sandra Day O'Connor, no mean judge of these things herself, said today he's a brilliant guy. I just wish he were, or worse to this effect, he just isn't a woman. I mean, it does make a difference, I suppose, whether you carry human life in a womb or not in terms of your understanding of life and the consequences.
I think my own view, and I think it's a view, if you really believe that if the Supreme Court is a representative body, it really should look more like America than it does. It just shouldn't be like lawyers. Lawyers have a very odd perspective on life. You should get other people making the decisions. Their comparative advantage is understanding the law as a stable system of meaning according to clear principles, and that should not change whether we have a man or a woman on the court.
Kate, what do you think of that?
Well, I just have to say that I'm sure there are tons of women that are equally as qualified. The fact we've chosen a white male, it's hard for me to believe that there's not plenty of women that could do it, or black women, or...
Of course, you could have a woman justice, a female justice, who was very opposed to Roe v. Wade.
You certainly could. However, the fact is there's only one woman left.
And your eye is right on that. Yes, Jack. Thanks, Kate, for your call.
In the Planned Parenthood Casey case, the basic abortion rights case of the early 90s, one of the things that really got Justice O'Connor angry at that Pennsylvania law was the stipulation in there that a woman had to get her husband's permission to get an abortion, and that offended her, and you could see it in her opinion. There was a kind of feminist resentment of this really antediluvian sort of regulation of woman's behavior. So I do think our caucator is absolutely right that there was a different voice in the court, certainly in that decision.
And now,
well, I don't think it ought to be overlooked that in 1973, when they decided Roe against Wade, it was an all-male court. And that's been the strongest statement by any court, any time, as to a woman's right to terminate a pregnancy. I think that's different than saying that we ought to have the court look, be more diverse. I think there's a lot to that. I think there's a lot to Professor McGinnis's point, too, as Senator Ruska once said in a judicial confirmation situation, when the nominee was accused of being mediocre. He said, well, mediocrity is also, should also be represented on the court.
Part of the national profile. Jesse Chopra, what's your sense when we're done with the Senate confirmation hearings? Are we going to know how much is John Roberts going to show his hand here, or are we simply going to have to wait for his 10 or 20 or 30 years on the court to understand where he may help take the country?
No, I don't think the Senate confirmation hearings are going to tell us very much about this sort of issue. I think one of the great advantages of John Roberts is that although he has a long paper trail of positions on issues, the great, great majority were taken when he was an advocate.
Mm-hmm.
And his position is going to be quite accurate. That lawyers often take positions as advocates that they need not believe in. And so some senator is going to turn around and say, well, yeah, that's true, but so we're asking you now, what do you believe in respect to these matters? And his answer, has been the answer of many nominees, is say, look, I think it's inappropriate for me to address specific issues, how I'm going to decide specific issues, or I'm inclined to decide when they're very likely to come before the court.
Jack Beatty, our future is likely to pass before our eyes in these hearings, but we may not be able to see what it is, it sounds like, this evening.
For a long time to come.
For a long time to come. Jesse Chopra at the Bolt Hall School of Law at the University of California at Berkeley. Wonderful to have you tonight. Thank you for joining us.
And
John McGinnis, professor at Northwestern University School of Law. Wonderful to have you with us as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
Enjoyed it.
Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.